Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a Wednesday podcast of the Nerdist, episode number 235.
I was really hoping you would back up sing right there, Katie.
Oh, I don't sing.
So, I mean... You listen to what I did. You think
mine would have been way worse.
Here, try it. Just nope. Here's all you have to do. After I say 235, then you just wait a beat, and then you just go 235. Okay.
Okay.
Welcome to a episode of the Nerdist Podcast number 235.
235.
See, that was wrong with that. That was fine. That was fine. Not amazing, but it was good. All right, it was good. Am I saying you should go start doing karaoke? Of course not. But it was pretty good what you just did there. So you got some real...
Thank you.
You got some real almost talent there, kid.
Thank you.
But what you got to do is really, like, push it really hard.
Try it.
235.
235.
I like it. All right. It sounded a little like you were pooping.
Yeah. It did.
I don't know why you would shout out numbers.
every
time I poop,
they count their poops.
I just count them. I just count them. I'm up to 20,042. Someone in the world has to have done that. Someone. Rule 34. Someone has to have done that at some point. It's counted all their poops. Now let's just take a pause for a second before I get to the sponsor part of the intro. Really? You went from poops to our product?
Hey.
It doesn't matter, because this episode is brought to you by Audible.com, and they're cool. They don't mind. Visit audible.com/nerdist to get a free audiobook download. They have thousands of books available. One book that I cannot recommend enough is Baratunde Thurston's How to Be Black. So get in on audible.com. He actually narrates it himself. He's got a good voice, too. Baratunde's got a good... He just has a good... He's got a good resonance to his voice. I'm kind of jealous of it.
It's very calming.
It is calming. So you could get that calming book, How to Be Black, from Baratunde Thurston. Again, that's audible.com/nerdist for your free audiobook download.
Okay, this episode, it's Richard Iowade. Oh, let's see. The IT Crowd, Submarine, Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. Also, sincere apologies for my accent. But Richard, and listen, we've had obviously some, you know, people on the show that we... super, super, super nerded out over, but I've never seen Jonah flip out so hard when he found out that Richard Iowade was going to be on the podcast. There was a lot of all caps in the text and a lot of question marks with exclamation points built on top of one another. That's got to have a name, right? An exclamatory question mark? I don't know. Anyway, this guy was so sweet and wonderful, and he's brilliant. And if you're not familiar with who he is, then just look him up and start watching everything he's been a part of. He comes from that kind of, that cluster of brilliant British comics that Chris Morris is sort of the godfather of. So it was a real, real tremendous honor to have him on. And he turned out to be a wonderful guy. So here you go. Here's Nerdist Podcast with Richard Iowade. Episode number 235. Also make sure and watch Richard's latest movie, The Watch, opening July 27th. Starring Vince Vaughn, Jonah Hill, Ben Stiller, and our pal, Johnny Pemberton. Now I'm even sorrier for this voice. All right.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
And we have started. Hey, Jonah Ray.
Hey.
Is this?
Sitting to Jonah Ray's immediate right is Richard Ayoade. Please tell me I said that correctly.
Yeah, no, it's good, good, good.
I feel bad for someone with a name like yours coming to the States and talking to American press to just imagine how butchered that becomes.
Oh, no, it's fine. I've lost confidence in how it's pronounced myself. I don't know. Yeah, that could be the correct pronunciation. It doesn't really matter. It's fine. Just you is a fine moniker.
Hey, you. Mm. Hey, guy.
That's all of them.
Guy Awade.
Yeah. Guy Awade.
They're good.
You, we are big fans of yours, and so we were thrilled that you agreed to come on our podcast.
Well, thank you, but I haven't agreed to come on.
Do you want to let us know when you do?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll see how it goes.
Okay. All right. So this is going to be sort of a, we'll do a post-game wrap-up after the podcast.
This is an interview.
We'll break it down. Oh, wow. I feel like the sort of the British accent kind of makes me feel more subjugated in a weird sort of way. Like I want to impress you. Mm. We want to impress you on this show.
Good. Well, we have an excellent track record at being cruel, dismissive, and unfeeling. But luckily, my personal racial lineage has got nothing to do with it, so I can have the accent without any of the ancestral guilt.
Excellent. Well, is it you're half Nigerian, half Norwegian? Is that correct?
Yep, another one. So yeah, we like to hang out together, all the Norwegian Nigerian kids. We don't really go out of that group.
There must be.
It's a hard click to get into. I tried in high school.
Yeah, it's very exciting when N comes around in the Olympics.
You get two teams. Actually, technically, it's three teams that you get to root for.
It's a great letter for me. And yes, I can also, root for. I love sport, and it's just a great time for me.
Do you like all the kicking?
The running.
The
hurling.
There's a lot of sticks that people throw and then jumping into sand.
I like it when they get all the points.
Oh, and the hammer.
Yeah.
Great.
What sport does a hammer?
The hammer. That is a sport, throwing the hammer.
Oh, that's, what is the thing? What you?
Well, they spin around.
Is that what that's called?
Yeah.
Spinning around.
The hammer.
All I know about the Olympics is what I learned playing track and field.
On the Nintendo?
In the arcade when I was a kid. That's how I know the hammer throw. But I think talk about a setup that made sense like 2,000 years ago. I think they were literally just trying to knock the gods off Olympus.
Yeah.
With tools. And we still do it.
Within 2.5 turns.
Good. Are you going back to London tonight?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
It must be not a fun time to be trying to navigate London.
Well, I've been filming outside London in a town called Wokingham, so I haven't been there for about 3 months, so I have no idea what's going on in London. Well, I know, I've had kind of cursory access to the media, but I'm not involved in having to navigate the town.
I think it's okay to just step over cars in the central London.
Okay, good. Yeah, I'm sure it's being handled admirably.
It was kind of, I was there 6 months ago, 7 months ago, and it was a nightmare even then just preparing for the Olympics.
Yeah, well, we like to get stressed about, anything, so it's good. If leaves fall, we find it very perturbing.
Now, I feel like that maybe there's a bit of a sense that the Brits like to get stressed and perturbed about things, but then they internalize it.
Yeah.
And then that turns into a rage ball that someday may come out.
Or just come out as a polite cough.
With a whole lot of subtext to it, that cough.
I beg your pardon.
There's a lot of subtext to that mucal dispellation. But, I don't know that we're amazing. I obviously speak on behalf of the nation, as you know.
Yes. That's why you're here as an ambassador for the podcast world.
I'm here as a precise representation of everyone in Britain.
But also to judge us, to take back judgments.
Yeah. Let's take that as read. I'm certainly here to judge you both individually and as a people.
So we could, we could not do well individually, Jonah, but you and I could still score if the American people. Nah, this isn't going to go well.
I think I'm going to like do so badly, I'm going to take everyone down with me.
Are you really?
That's the feeling I get.
Every morning when you wake up.
Every morning, yeah.
You always feel that way. You were president of Footlights, which is that's so amazing. I mean, what an incredible.
Well, it was uncontested in my year. No one was interested.
But you still campaigned.
No, I mean literally, you no one wanted to do it. The only people who sort of vaguely did comedy in my year was kind of me, John Oliver, and a few others. And it was very uncool at the time. It was when Chris Morris was doing, you know, all of that incredible stuff on the day to day and on the hour, and just people trying to do Alan Partridge voices, but being 19.
And that's where you met Matthew Holness, right?
Yeah, but the whole thing was, ill-advised. So, yes.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad everyone, because in the States, in the late 90s, every comedy sketch improv person was trying to do that Chicago accent from Second City.
Right.
And like the Chris Farley, you know.
Yeah,
And then it's pleasing to me to know that you had your version of that, and it was the Alan Partridge voice.
Yeah, that was the Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Then everything changed.
And sort of is still. Just, yeah, everyone did that.
But for people who don't know, Footlights is it's sort of the. I mean, I guess you would call it a drama club, maybe, but it's like a 130-year-old performers club at Cambridge.
Yeah, which has a sort of undeserved ability to put on shows because it housed some geniuses before and you know, some people who are really great. And so when you're in it, you just feel embarrassed that you're even kind of nominally saying that you're associated with these other people, which you just aren't, except through, you know, a name. And you're pretty, I mean, I was, you know, unforgivably bad and, you know, haven't particularly transcended that since. And so it's just embarrassing. You know, Peter Cook was in it and Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie and, you know.
Half the Python guys.
Yeah, those are really funny people. Yeah.
I think that's
embarrassing.
That right there is culturally the most significant difference, I think, between the Brits and the Americans. Is the Brits, even when they're, from my perspective, even when they're doing something that does say, "Hey, look at me, I'm doing this thing," there's still a sense of "Please don't look at me doing this thing." Whereas in America, we would have glommed onto that. I'm in Footlights. Here's my Footlights sweatshirt. Here's my Footlights hat. Like, yeah. We are very braggadocious about our associations.
Well, different people have different responses to it. I, you know, in my year, it was, no one really wanted to do it. It'd fallen very out of fashion. And just the kind of comedy that was around was so, like, from the 80s, had really moved on. And it suddenly felt very elitist or snobby or, you know, just something to be somewhat ashamed of. Just because you just had completely unearned privileges. You know, you just, like, Footlights did a show in Edinburgh every year in a 300-seater theatre of unknowns, you know, completely unknown comedians.
Did you still have to flyer for it and stuff?
Yeah, we flyered. we didn't have butlers. But it's just, you know, it was booked on the strength of the name. And, you know, these other comedians who had been doing comedy for 5 years and worked stuff up and had great renown were, you know, in 100-seater theatre. So you instantly felt kind of guilty and awful and undeserving. And I mean, you really were undeserving of it. But there was a kind of curiosity that someone might spot someone who might be, you know, as good as Hugh Laurie. And that doesn't happen very often.
Is there any kind of process for getting into Footlights, or do you just say, "I'm just going to start showing up to things"?
It's kind of the latter. You just start showing up. I mean, there's they have a president and they have auditions, and when you go in the first year, people audition sketches, and there are these things called smokers where people try stuff out. But yeah, it's like auditioning for any drama club, really.
I remember the first time I ever heard of Footlights, it was on an episode of The Young Ones, where they did like some sort of a college quiz bowl, and the competing team was called Footlights College, and it was like Emma Thompson and I think Hugh Laurie and
Stephen Fry,
and it was they were just
obnoxious,
totally obnoxious.
Yeah, potheads. Yeah, that's kind of not utterly undeserved.
What's the analogy to that? Do you think it's the Lampoon, the Harvard Lampoon, John Ray?
Yeah, it seems, because it is through the college, right? It's through the university?
Yeah, I mean...
you have to be a student there to be a part of Footlights?
Sort of, although you can, like Tim Key wasn't, and he was in Footlights. And, you know, some people, like I think Sacha Baron Cohen, he went to Cambridge, but wasn't in Footlights, maybe, I'm not sure.
Yeah, because the Harvard Lampoon, and the Harvard Lampoon is... It's more of a rag. It's right. Not a performance place. Right. So yeah.
But it is sort of it's their version of the comedy institution.
Yeah, that's the
of Harvard.
The highbrow comedy institution. Right?
Simon Bird was in Footlights too, from Inbetweeners.
Oh really?
He was a totally sweet guy.
Yeah, he was.
I was in the UCLA comedy club. Doesn't even exist anymore.
I took a TV class at Santa Monica Community College.
Well, that's how you got into the business.
That's how I got into the business, yeah.
So you worked with Chris Morris and that cluster of...
Yeah. Yeah, that was very intimidating when that happened. Because he, you know, I know him now, which is strange, but he was and is utterly revered and seen as just a kind of mythical figure.
What was the first thing you worked at? Was it Nathan Barley?
Yeah, and... I don't know how it works now, but you don't really ever get the part in a film or a thing that he does. You just at some stage stop auditioning. So you have about 9 auditions and then it starts to film and you go, oh, maybe I'm in it. So it's that.
How was he in a room to audition for?
I mean, initially I was sort of, I found it very intimidating because I completely idolized him and, you know, still do. He's great. So it was just very intimidating and just odd. But he's the complete opposite probably of what people would expect in that he's just incredibly nice and welcoming and, you know, he's great. He's one of the truly undisappointing people, which sounds like very faint praise, but, you know, when you... think of someone as a kind of magical unicorn, and he just is better than you'd expect. You know, he's just great.
Have you seen Four Lions?
I've not seen Four Lions.
It's a beautiful fucking movie.
Yeah, he's great.
He's really, really good.
I mean, I was a huge fan of Day to Day and Brass Eye, and which, you know, I saw in London, and when I was in London years ago, and then had to get the had to use one of my conversions on my computer to be able to watch the region.
Oh, that's right. Because you can only do it.
You can only
five times.
Do it like 5 times.
Yeah,
but it was totally.
People don't seem to have region-free DVD players here, do they?
I do, just because a while back it was just getting into it. Was just it made the process easier. I wasn't really a computer guy, but you can just buy those little Kobe.
Yeah.
You know, no region.
But Americans are so unforgivably America-centric. And I think, you know, part of that is just because of the geography of our country. We're fairly isolated.
There's a lot here as well.
Yeah.
You're not silly to rely on your own resources.
But it's mostly the same throughout, though.
Yeah, whereas
topography.
mountains and beaches.
You've got
oceans.
You've got a couple of oceans.
Yeah. We have a bay, I think.
Yep. There's some boats, probably.
A sound.
There's a sound, Puget Sound.
Yeah.
I don't know how many sounds we have.
Got a couple deltas.
Yeah. It's a couple deltas in the Mississippi region. But just being able to be in Europe and, you know, and within the course of the day see several different countries on a train is pretty remarkable to us.
Sure. Yeah. You know, there's stuff in Europe. I'm not going to deny that. there's also, you know, a lot here. But to me, it seems, and why would you not have a region-free DVD player? It just seems so odd.
Yeah, it's easy. That's how I was able to get into Nathan Barley and Garth Marenghi and Man to Man and stuff like that.
Well, Criterion. That's why I have to have. It'd be impossible. It'd be unthinkable. not having Criterion DVDs. What would you do?
But that's another. That's another. I mean, British comedy for us is so. It's such a universe, and you know, for instance, spinning off Dean Lerner from Garth Marenghi into his own show. That sort of tangentialism that British television has, where they go, oh, we did 6 or 10 episodes of this one show. Here's this other character, and we're just going to spin off a thing with that guy, or we're going to follow Alan Partridge further in his life. Like that idea seems like so much fun to play with, because here we just get locked into, let's just do 12 seasons of this one show because it was successful for a season.
I think it's probably a lot of grass is greener, though, because I think English people would, you know, look at things like Cheers and that are incredible and fully develop, you know, one amazing kind of premise, and it's filled with these great characters, and they have time to develop it, and you know, they have the resources to keep it going. And often those things in England are done out of necessity, because no one can survive off doing 6 shows.
Sure.
And so they end up having to do other things, and you can't get the people back because they're in the middle of the other thing, or by the time you get them back, no one cares anymore.
Right.
Well,
so
what are the rumors of there being a second series of Nathan Barley?
I don't know.
Because I've been hearing about it for like 5 years, I think.
I think they were talking about it for a while, but I'm not sure where they're at with it. Like Charlie Brooker's, he's doing this thing called Black Mirror now, which are these sort of one-off dramas, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I read about that.
Yeah, so he's doing them, and Chris is, you know, he's always doing something. So I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't know what they do.
It would be interesting to catch up with everybody and see, like, you know, how much bigger and, like, much more popular Nathan Barley could have gotten.
Who knows what they'll do.
Yeah. I heard a story, I'm not sure if it's true or not, but that there was originally, they picked up Garth Marenghi for two series. And
no.
No, it wasn't.
No.
Okay. Well, did you guys plan on just doing the 6 episodes, then spinning it off? Or was that a...
I mean, not really. No, it's always weird to talk about it without Matt, and because we've never talked about it sort of ever out of character, which people were always delighted when someone would say, you're on the phone now with Garth and Dean, and you can hear them go, oh. They realized they'd hear some character stuff.
That's why I like the commentary on the This Is Spinal Tap. They do commentary as Spinal Tap.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, we did the commentary for Dark Place and character. It's because it's a show about people talking about how great they are. To talk about that show is impossible. Because otherwise I go, when we did the show about the bunch of idiots talking about how great they are, weren't we great?
There are so many levels. There are so many levels. You're like, wait, oh, no way, I'm doing this character, commenting on this character, and they're both, that's part of a...
Yeah, there should be, like, a 10-year anniversary where there's, like, you just go through each episode as the characters, looking back at the replay of the...
I mean, I certainly think the barnstorming commercial success of the first one would... It'd simply be a matter of deciding whose money we'd accept first.
Is there any sense... Because I often wonder... how empowered writer performers feel in the BBC system. Whereas, you know, here at a certain, you know, if a show is a hit, then all of a sudden the actors, then it's like everyone bends over backwards to keep them happy. And I get the sense in the BBC, they're like, well, we're the government and fuck yourself. You know, you don't like, do you feel empowered sometimes as a performer, or do they sort of treat you guys as just employees?
Well, I think it's different. I haven't really done anything for the BBC of my own. Because Garth Marenghi was on Channel 4, and it was on it was a slightly strange time when Big Brother was very big and popular.
You had a Big Brother channel.
Yeah, it was very, and so it was a slightly different climate, probably. And please kill me for using the term climate in relation to
Jonah,
TV.
Administer the injection.
Yeah. Well, I'm on the fence about the term.
Oh, okay.
I can go either way.
All right, but we'll see.
No, that was unforgivable. and must be erased from all records. The TV climate at the time was very interesting. So it was weird. It felt a very weird time. Just that being on TV was so odd. It was like, yeah, the year of the Sex Olympics or something. And so it was, so Channel 4 is a commercial station with adverts and all of that. So I think the BBC's not the same as that. In this, but, I mean, I don't know. I mean, everything I've done has been cancelled. What the hell do I know? I can't sort of speak from any position other than maybe avoid what I've done. I don't know. I'm sure someone like Steve Coogan is empowered because he's the character and he writes it, you know, with Armando and Peter Bainham and stuff. So I don't think I've been in that position.
Mm. Well, the IT crowd, they actually, I know Joel McHale was, yeah. You did the American version too, didn't you? Mm-hmm. What was your experience like taking because we've had a long history in this country of...
You almost said company.
We've had a long history in this company, the company being America, in the current climate,
yeah.
Which you see on the spreadsheets I've yes. laid out before you, various flowcharts and whatnot.
Yeah.
But the idea that, you know, we got to take this hit British show and then make it big here in the States, and they never understand, we do technically speak some of the same language, mm-hmm. but there's an entire layer of subtext and social interaction and that is... completely not the same, and they miss it a lot.
Yeah, or like with The Office, it's great. You know, I think it probably has a similar hit and miss rate to everything, in that a number of shows that are indigenously created are also awful, but there's no kind of cross fertilization story. You know,
sure.
I mean, I think English people manage to make a number of dire things on their own. Americans make a bunch of turgid dreck on their own.
Mostly.
And sometimes we take your turgid dreck and make even worse stuff and vice versa. So, I mean, who knows what happens, and, you know.
Don't leave out Australia. They do it too.
Yeah, Australia, Belgium.
Well, the classic story of
Dutch.
We're going to make your show is... Coupling coming after Friends, and then America trying to bring Coupling back to the States.
Yeah,
that was odd. I never really saw Coupling. But you know, I don't know. Was that on for a long time? Did they make a number?
It was a big bomb.
They piloted that show,
right?
2 or 3 years in a row. They kept trying to make it work and kept trying to make it work, and then it just never worked here.
Yeah.
I think generally, I think it's hard unless there are some people at the core of something who really care about it. I think mm-hmm. it is hard. And I think if you are adapting a show that's previously existed, it's always a bit weird because you can't quite feel ownership of it. It's not quite come from you. It's,
sure.
It's always odd. Whereas I guess Greg Daniels on The Office has a very distinct, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
That probably was the motor that helped it as well.
Then there's like, you know, you got guys like Armando Iannucci that just came to the States and made a type of show that he was already kind of making, but didn't bother doing like a remake of it. Just kind of, and then he made Veep,
right?
And it's just that seems to be the better way of going about it. Just, you know, coming here and then building it from the ground up, as opposed to just trying to alter something.
I think, didn't the year before, I think they made another version of The Thick of It and it didn't work.
Oh, really?
I definitely did another pilot earlier and it didn't work out and wasn't, I think, what he wanted. So, you know, I think it's hard, I think, to make something.
I mean, obviously you're in The Watch, mm-hmm. with Ben Stiller and
Johnny Pemberton.
And Johnny Pemberton's in the movie?
Yeah, he's featured pretty big in the trailer.
Oh, that's fantastic.
There.
And Jonah Hill?
Yeah.
Yeah, Johnny Pemberton, he's the youngest looking.
The boy wonder.
It's incredible.
Even with a mustache, you're always like, wipe that off your face, kiddo.
Yeah.
He's a good kid.
He makes beer. He started making his own beer.
Really?
Yeah.
Age-defying beer.
Yes, exactly. And the funniest thing, too, is like the kind of music he listens to is like the oldest timey music. It's like his whole thing, his whole record collection is just 45s, like of old garage bands and blues stuff.
He's like one of those guys that you probably like in Capone's court. There's like one, like a babyface Nelson kind of guy. You're like, yeah, look at that kid. And then before you know what's happening, he's cut you in half with a Tommy gun.
A silent killer.
He would be an excellent killer because you'd never see it coming.
Yeah, well, he should maybe look at that. That's a thing to develop. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, he's in it.
Yeah.
He was a thoroughly pleasant fellow.
He said the same thing about you.
Oh, good. Yeah. Good. Yeah, no, I liked him a lot.
Yeah, he said you have a lot of opinions on cheese.
I don't, but let's say I do.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't remember. Maybe he was talking about... Yeah, I was trying just to find non-orange cheese in America.
So you do have an opinion.
Why? American.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of... Oh, maybe... Yeah, it's odd because everything's like pasteurized, isn't it? It's all...
Yeah, it's bright.
Yeah, it's good. You can locate it in the dark.
Thanks, Louis Pasteur, you dickhead.
Yeah.
Fucking ruined our cheese.
But it is a bit odd. No cheese should be able to bounce.
Well, but our cheese has to last for decades.
Yeah, it has a nuclear half-life of, you know, 75 years.
If there is a nuclear blast, you are to make a cheese suit.
Yeah, Keith Richards and American cheese and anything
that you, if you can get behind either one of those things to absorb the majority of the blast.
Cockroach, American cheese, Keith Richards.
Keith Richards. Johnny Pemberton.
Yeah.
Johnny Pemberton.
Who eats probably a lot of the yellow cheese
and
therefore has adopted many of its properties.
He is bright.
He is. And adorable.
Yeah.
There was one of our email newsletter went out today and the idea was, you know, here are five British shows that should be brought back.
Right.
So I kind of wanted to get your opinion on these. It's if you've seen them.
Okay.
Sapphire and Steel. Did you ever see Sapphire and Steel?
I haven't seen as much as I'd like, but sure. I've probably seen one.
David McCollum and Joanna Lumley played Elements Made Human, who investigated frightening supernatural events caused by rips in the fabric of time.
It has a good title sequence, I remember.
It's like a total, like the most 80s looking title sequence you could ever imagine.
That's good.
Blake 7? That one I don't know.
I never really watched Blake 7. That and Doctor Who I never ever saw.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. I'll be okay.
Okay.
Robin of Sherwood, the 80s Robin of Sherwood.
I remember that one.
I think so. Maybe.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
The Tripods?
Uh-huh.
I didn't know that one.
Okay.
Mid-80s TV adaptation of John Christopher's War of the Worlds, Planet of the Apes hybrid. Only covered 2/3 of the story, it said, so they were asking for a remake.
Wow.
And, of course, Red Dwarf.
These are quite specific.
These are very specific. There are three...
Sci-fi.
I feel like I know a lot of...
Good.
British stuff, and those three. I mean, I knew Sapphire and Steel, but I didn't know those three. Red Dwarf, of course.
Right. Is that the consensus? That's the kind of votes have been counted, and it was those?
No, I think it was just...
that's one dude.
That's one guy.
Okay, fine.
That's one guy who wanted to see these shows remade.
Okay, fine.
And there are... Did Red Dwarf get remade, or it's being... Or they're doing another set of them?
Maybe they're just still doing them.
I think so.
Is that popular here, Red Dwarf?
With comedy nerds.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think. Maybe not... The majority of the population probably wouldn't know what you were talking about.
Okay.
But I think for those of us, I mean, the thing about the kind of comedy nerd thing is that in the 80s, before we had internet, people like myself would seek out British comedy because it was just more, there was a quest in finding it to begin with that was satisfying. And just the idea that it was just drier and more academic and, like, you know, like I've said a million times before, the first time I went to London in like 96, I expected all British comedy to be this really brilliant academic kind of, and then I found out that most of it was not like that.
You went to Jonglers or what happened?
I don't remember what I saw. I was just between some of the stuff that some of the sitcoms that I saw and then just going to some comedy clubs and being like, oh yeah, it's just like, this is like middle America here.
Yeah. That can happen.
Do you do stand-up?
No. I did for a brief period of time to an alarming level of mediocrity. And yeah, I was not good at stand-up. It's hard. There's maybe 8 good stand-ups ever.
Yeah.
It's really hard to be good at it.
Well, there's also, there seems to be kind of a stand-up comedy boom in London right now.
Yeah.
Which is...
It's huge.
Kind of the antithesis of what's going on here, where a lot of comedy clubs have closed down.
Oh, really? Okay. No, it's quite... There's a stand-up show on TV that was very popular.
And they're making the set list into a show.
Oh, they're doing set lists?
Yeah, in England.
Have you seen Set List? Mm-mm. It's an improvised stand-up show.
Oh, right. Okay.
And when it works, it's amazing.
Yeah. Okay.
But when it doesn't work...
Still fun.
Like the time I did it.
Oh, really?
I did not have a good set.
It's tough. That's the thing. It's a gamble.
I know. Yeah. That's, you know, it's...
Matt Kirshen, he's the best I've seen at it.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
Yeah.
Are you directing, because you've directed a lot of stuff. You directed television. Are you directed an episode of Community? You've directed some others.
Submarine.
Submarine, yes, of course. Submarine.
It's a really good movie.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Do you prefer...
You're
not comfortable with compliments, are you?
Oh, I thrive. I'm no good. Yes. Thank you is the polite answer.
You're going to get hugged.
I can't do it.
We're going to hug you, Richard.
You don't need to.
We're going to both hug you at the same time, and we're not going to let go until you're like, okay, I accept the love that you're giving.
Until I climax.
and then for 2 minutes after.
Good. I'm directing something at the moment that we have 3 days left of filming on called The Double, which is based on this Dostoevsky book. And I've worked on it with R.V. Kareen, who co-wrote Mr. Lonely with his brother Harmony. And it's got Jesse Eisenberg and Mia Wasikowska.
Oh, excellent.
So, yeah, we're just finishing it up.
Is directing just another facet of something that you enjoy, or do you not want to perform anymore? Would you be happy just directing?
I'm happy writing. I guess that's the thing I spend most time doing. But I like directing a lot. Performing is something I do intermittently, and I'm not. Especially when you work with really good actors, you realize you really ought to get out of the way of this as a thing. So, you know, I'm able to sort of vaguely say things out loud in a string, but I can't really act at all. So, yeah, I would certainly not weep were I going to perform again.
Dean Lerner, he was a good actor.
Dean is good. Dean's better than me. But, I'm not one of those people who can just be... there's some people who are just good in everything and just that's their kind of natural ability. That is not me. I don't have that ability. I have to be kind of forced to do something.
How did you get into making music videos? Was it just kind of...
I met Warp Films, and I'd always really liked the Arctic Monkeys, and they had just done some stuff with them, and so it was fortuitous that I didn't really know what I was going to do at that time, but had always wanted to do music videos, and just I had a lucky chance to do, you know, a video for them. And so,
in the timeline of it, was it like post Dean Lerner?
Yeah, it was sort of around then, and it was really good timing because I was able to try some things out, but they were small, and you know, you. From the idea of it to finishing it is a couple of weeks, and so that was quite a good thing to be doing while I think I was writing Submarine, so I could still practice directing.
Yeah.
A lot of people are directing hot chip videos these days. Those guys seem to put out a video like every week.
They do. And so is Peter Serafinowicz.
Peter Serafinowicz.
Yeah. He's done one.
Yeah.
I think he did a second one.
Really?
I think so, recently.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
I think so. The one the original one he did is awesome.
Was that the one with Reggie was in? Reggie Watts was in?
No.
That's the second one.
That's the second one. The first one is just a weird-looking guy that just starts shooting energy, I guess, out of his mouth. Is that?
Right. They're at the concert.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he just starts floating around, just blazing people.
Is there sort of a cluster of that I like to imagine of just like, all these great comedy people that just hang out because the British performing community is small enough?
I'm sure there is.
Well, because you've done some stuff with like Matt Berry. Yeah. And Rich Fulcher.
You were in the pilot of Mighty Boosh.
Yes, I was. Mm. Yeah, and then I wasn't able to do the series. But I mean, and not loads. I see Noel and Julian and people, but not really. I mean, I don't really go out that much. I'm not that social. I sort of see my wife. She's pretty much the only person left who'll still tolerate me. Not really, I don't think.
No. What was the process of making ADBC a rock opera? Was that pitched as a one-off thing that you and Matt would write?
Yeah. That technically wasn't cancelled.
Yeah, because it was just a one-off.
Because we got in first and went, there's only going to be one.
I'm not sure if you ever saw, but it's basically a 70s stage play musical filmed special for the story of the Nativity. And Matt Berry, what was Matt Berry's character's name?
Well, he plays Tim Wind, and then he plays the innkeeper in it.
Yes, yeah, the story of Nativity is set from the perspective of the innkeeper that ends up letting, you know, Joseph and Mary have Jesus in their barn.
This is just a one-off special for...
Surprisingly, this didn't make it to series. Although I felt it could have run for at least 50. And Julian Barrett was in it as a rival innkeeper.
Yeah.
With a very short...
Get out! Togo.
And so, yeah, it was Matt Berry's idea to... He was going to do a kind of Christmas musical. He's always doing musical things. Then when I was going to direct it, we just kind of ended up writing it together, and he did the music. And so,
yeah,
it was always going to be a kind of a one-off thing, really.
All of the British comics that I've met, you and Noel Fielding and Simon Bird and Simon Pegg, and like everyone's so sweet and a little shy, and you know. So, do you find that performing is just sort of a release to step out of that a little bit?
Well, I mean, Noel and... I mean, all of them are sort of proper performers, and I have generally been happy tinkering behind proper performers. So, I don't know. Like, there are certain things that... I don't know. I'm not naturally given to standing on the table and shouting at a party, but within very strict parameters it can be enjoyable. So like doing Dean was enjoyable because it was kind of like writing, you know, you have a sort of character with a Rolodex of peculiarities of some kind, and then you flip through them in a nasal voice. And so you know, I can just about cope with that. Yeah, it's odd because people could very legitimately say, then why are you doing this? And there isn't a good answer to that, because I think it's more like a sort of infection making things. You know, it's not something that necessarily you're even suited to. In fact, I think I did this Jungian personality test and it said, the one thing I should not be in is show business.
It didn't tell you what to do. It just said the one thing not to do.
Not suited to show business. And in a way, that is true. I'm very not suited to it.
I think everyone feels that way, though. I think every good performer feels exactly the way you do, that it's like, oh, everyone's going to realize that I shouldn't be doing this, and there are people who are better. And I don't know. I think more people feel that way.
Yeah, possibly. I suppose why directing appeals is all you really have to do is have an opinion on what you like, and I'm quite comfortable with that.
Yeah.
As in, I can go, oh, I like Jesse Eisenberg. Let's ask him if he'll do this. You know, I'm quite comfortable with that, and going, oh, I like that bit of what you do. you know, and I like this music here, and I think this should be this long. And so that's fine. But in terms of the kind of more, you know, the sense of you as a performer, I find that very hard to be objective about. And yeah, I'm very uncomfortable with that as a idea. And, you know, I'm very happy to do it under controlled circumstances occasionally, but I'd find it just terrifying if that was like my job.
Sure.
Yeah, the one thing.
Yeah, I'd go. I mean, I would never hire me.
Can you watch your own stuff?
No.
No.
No, I can't. No, I don't watch it. And yeah, I'm terrible at auditions and just don't audition. I just refuse. Not in a high-minded way, but just for everyone's sake. Just to spare everyone the time.
Do you feel uncomfortable when you're running an audition?
Oh, I hate it. It's awful. I'll do everything to avoid making people have to read. Generally, I just try and talk to people and see if they're all right. And I like, and then that's it.
Yeah, that's the Woody Allen style. He doesn't ever have them read. He just...
Well, it's just the audition process is weird because it's artificial. And it to have someone, you know, read a bunch of dialogue in that weird artificial scene... I like yeah. that approach. Is like you can get a sense of whether or not someone has a clue of what's going on yeah. just by talking to them.
I think so. And also, you know, there's some people who are incredible at auditions. Like Chris O'Dowd is you know, because he's a great actor, but he's the kind of person you give 8 notes to and he can do them all. And, you know, he's just great. But the underlying thing in any audition is I'd like this job or I want to not be told I can't have this job. Or,
sure. Yeah.
So that exists as a oddness in the room that just makes it impossible, I think, for people really to perform.
Right.
Unless, you know, they're so good. I mean, I can't imagine Chris O'Dowd would ever not get the job because he's so good. So that probably just doesn't exist for him. So he's just fine.
He was great in Girls, his episodes of Girls.
He's always good. Like, yeah. He's just never... Yeah, he's great.
Well, the other side of it, too, is that... Any good scene of more than one person is a relationship that is built based on whatever sort of organic energy percolates between two people. And so if you're reading with a casting person or a producer...
And they're doing it for the 20th
time. And they're just doing like this. And then you have to somehow engage them in this scene. Your energy is largely based on what they're doing. Unless they're like huge monologues... I find it to be a shitty process.
Yeah, they're hard. And, you know, people sort of feel defensive in them, which is the opposite of what you want. And, yeah, I hate putting anyone through it. So I just find it just awful.
What do you have anything that you like to do outside of performing? What kind of...
Oh, nothing. Just performing.
I mean, you must... No. What do you collect anything?
I
you
have hate not performing. I'm so unhappy not performing.
If you're not on a stage.
I like being at home and seeing my family and I watch films and...
What have you been watching lately?
Well, mainly just the Master trailer.
Yeah, yes. I watched that thing like 10 times.
Yeah, I just watch that anytime I'm near a computer. Yeah, just the Master trailer, more or less.
Have you seen that yet?
I've been hearing about it, but I haven't seen it yet.
Even the other weird teaser one before that he put out, that 30-second one.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
I sort of think he's maybe better than Stanley Kubrick now.
Really?
He's just so good. Yeah, he's pretty good.
Yeah. I can't wait for that movie.
Yeah.
Do you see the trailer for Sleepwalk With Me, the Mike Birbiglia movie?
No.
It looks pretty good, too. Okay. A lot of stylistic choices. And
okay.
Yeah.
I don't know what have I been looking at. I watched Blowout again recently, which I
really... Oh, yeah.
I like Hitchcock at the moment a lot. You know that guy.
Hitchcock. Randy Hitchcock?
Hitchcock.
Hitchcock,
Robin
the singer.
Hitchcock, yeah.
Yeah, he did Transformers.
Yep, Robin Hitchcock did Transformers.
Yeah. But The Wrong Man, I'm really into that Hitchcock film.
Oh, yeah.
It was great. So, yeah, I watch a lot of old things, mainly.
Yeah.
Do you watch a lot? I find that I don't watch a lot of comedy, weirdly. As much as I'm in the comedy business, that I don't see a lot of comedies.
Oh, really?
I tend to just like more like sci-fi, horror, action stuff.
Yeah, I don't seek it out so much. I mean, I genuinely really like Community, which I started watching because I knew Joel. But I thought, you know, I think that's a great show, and it seems somewhat bold of them to try to do it without Dan.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
I love everyone on the show. I hope it goes well for them.
Yeah, no, the cast are great. And, you know, it must be a weird feeling for them.
It's got to be hard because they...
Well, they have to... Yeah, they're
contractually... They're contractually obligated to show up for work.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really odd. Yeah.
It's actually the guys that took over are the guys that did the American version of the IT Crowd.
Well, they're really nice. I mean, they're really good. But it's kind of Dan, isn't it? I mean...
Yeah. Well, it's his show.
Yeah.
It's weird.
It's a little weird.
Yeah.
But you know what? I mean, this fucking... The business is hard enough. It's just sort of, I don't think anyone faults them for wanting to keep their jobs, you know? And, they're hilarious people.
Yeah. So. I mean, the show's set up, I think, at a point right now where it's just, they just kind of have to keep on pushing it in the same direction. If they try to alter any of the relationships or the style choices, I think it's just, I don't know, there's so much that Dan brought, so many like layers of different things.
How much in British television, how much does the network get involved in the production, or do they pretty much go, you know, here's your money, just go make your thing and give it to us?
Oof. I've never done more than one series of something I've been involved with writing. So, I mean, we were pretty lucky. We didn't have much interference. Even if we'd had, we wouldn't have listened. But that's maybe why we only got to do one series. I'm just constitutionally, I can't do it. I'm so counter-suggestible that if someone, as long as you're able to, as long as it's your decision and you're not forced, I think it's fine to have as many notes as possible. But as soon as it becomes a power struggle, it's just, you know, useless and worthless, and it just becomes about people digging in. So I sort of think relatively arbitrary whether this joke or that joke, so I think you may as well have one person who cares about whether it's funny making the decision rather than one person who cares about it being popular, because no one knows what's popular. So as a bet, it's better to go, I would bet with Dan Harmon, who knows what's funny and is interested in something being funny, rather than someone who's tried to make something popular, which I imagine is what an executive legitimately has as a job. But just as a bet, it would be more prudent to go with a funny person.
They usually say something really interesting, which I think it is about how you direct, is the idea of like, well, this joke or that joke doesn't really matter when it becomes a power struggle. So when you're directing, are you open in that sense where you just sort of like everyone kind of pitches in and then you pick whichever is the funniest thing, or do you like to stick to the book pretty much?
No, I mean, you have hope for something better all the time, you know, for someone to have a better idea, which is seldom difficult. I mean, that's the whole point. The difficulty is that if the only reason something isn't something is because it's been forced, then that's terrible, whether it's the person in charge who has that power or anyone. You sort of want the criteria of it to be, you know, what you think best reflects what it could be, if that's not too many clauses. But I don't know, you just have an idea of what you think it is and what works, and things either fit into that or not. And it's relatively, you know, it's incredibly subjective, you know, whether you how long is it funny for this to happen.
Right,
you just kind of guess at it.
What was your experience when you were directing the Community episode, the dinner?
It was really good. Yeah, I really enjoyed it, and it was written very, you know, right up to the wire. I mean, they didn't have scripts until the night before, and for me, it was just very interesting seeing the writer's room, and I was allowed to go in and see how it worked, and yeah, I really liked the show, and for me, it was a great pleasure to do. And I didn't know it was going to necessarily be that episode when I said I'd do it. And it was
Oh, really?
Just really great for me.
Because it did seem up your alley.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I love Louis Malle. I sort of thought this was a joke when they said this. It's a Louis Malle thing. I went, oh, wow, okay, great, yeah.
What do you think is the most essential element to making something work when you're directing? Is it the actors or the writing or the direction or the editing or even the lighting or the sound, the music?
Well, I suppose they all are important, but you can't, if the acting's bad, that's it. You know, there's nothing you can do about it, really. So, yeah, I think that's probably the most important thing. You know, you can have something that's not brilliantly lit and can still be interesting. But, yeah, if you've got bad acting, it's over.
Yeah.
Are you available? Do you have much of an online presence?
I have no online presence. I have email.
But no, otherwise none. No, there's no. You're not on social media. There's no.
No, I'd be unconfident of even defining social media.
Well, in the current climate, it's the way that the young people are communicating across. It's a paradigm shift from. It's a 2012 climate.
Great. So what are these kids doing?
I don't know what the hell kids are doing.
Tweet decks.
They're on tweet decks and Facebookings.
Good. I have nothing.
I think that's, part of me feels like, I don't know how I would exist without being interconnected in that way. And I always have respect.
It's pretty lonely. But you should try it.
I don't know if I could. I don't know if I could. I'm too.
You never thought about trying to just disconnect for a little bit?
Mm-mm.
Really?
Yeah.
What are like you, even cyborgs? Like a...
Yes. Well, this is the Matrix, and you're just down. You're all projections of our consciousness.
Am I like the old person at the end of a rap video?
What are you talking about?
What do you want to do with your life?
And then we hand you a boombox, and then you get hip.
Yeah. No, I've. But you're massively plugged in to stuff.
I guess so.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's. I mean, I've had computers for 30 years and been online since 1994, and it's just a part
They opened up the internet
when they finally swung the doors open.
I've started trying to just leave my phone at home or in the car when I go out now. If I'm going out to hang out with friends or go to a bar, and
what if someone needs to find you? What if you're trying to settle a bar bet and there's no Guinness Book of World Records in the bar, or you need to know the fastest way to exit a building if it's burning?
I guess I just have to try and feel it out, I guess. But like
you're going to die like everyone did in the old days. They're all dead. You know why? No technology.
But it feels good. I actually end up having a better time. Like when I'm just like talking with people and engaging, you should try it.
The best way to hang out with people is four people at a table and everyone's faces in their phones.
Then everyone takes a picture of everyone else.
And then they're tweeting each other, but they're not actually talking.
Then they all Instagram it.
So The Watch is opening soon. August, is it?
God, can we stop talking about that film?
I'm so sorry. I know.
No. Did you want to talk about it?
No, I mean...
Oh, July 27th.
Does she want you to talk about it?
I don't know. It's probably best that I mean, I don't think I'd elevate it in any way by my voice saying things.
I'm looking forward to it. I've heard good things.
Good.
The people I've talked to that have seen it.
I hear Johnny Pemberton's in that movie.
Johnny Pemberton.
Yeah, Johnny Pemberton.
Johnny P.
Yep.
He's in it. He's good.
Excellent.
I'm looking forward to it. It seems like a big high concept comedy.
So my last question for you before we let you leave the country and go back to England is...
I have a question too.
My question is, have you agreed to do the podcast?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Oh, good.
I'm in it now.
Good.
Oh, good. In that case, is there any projects that you and Matthew Holness will ever get to work on again?
Like,
do you guys
ever
think about working together on a show or a movie?
I don't think so at the moment.
You're not friends anymore?
I don't think there's anything in the pipeline. I mean, I'm just going to...
What's the climate in that pipeline?
The climate is kind of a... I'd say it's hailing, but with patches of sun.
So it's sunny, humid. But hailing in the pipeline.
Yeah. And it's humid, weirdly.
And quite misty.
Yeah.
But also, there's some... It just smells bad as well.
Yeah.
In the pipeline.
So nothing's really going on.
It's a complex pipeline. No, there's nothing going on. I'm just trying to bring commercial failure to other projects.
Yeah, yeah. You guys are going off separately to try and fail apart.
Yeah, yeah. That's the aim. That's always been the aim, really, to spread the failure as widely as possible.
Well, I know a guy who happens to have access to creating content for the web, okay. The interweb. And if you ever wanted to do something, this person who could be me would produce it if you ever wanted to go that way. Good. It's just something to take home with you. Good. It's a long flight to, you know.
And I can take my climate metaphors as well and try and untangle them.
We can try to clear out the pipeline.
Well, thank you.
And get the lines of communication open.
Here's the twist. This isn't even a podcast. This is just a meeting.
Good. This is
a pitch.
We record all our meetings.
I've pitched myself admirably, I think.
You have such a lovely voice. We usually say something at the end of the podcast. We tell people to enjoy their burrito. Would you please do that for us? Because it sounds much nicer coming out of your face.
You tell people to enjoy their burrito.
You've just done it, and it was gorgeous.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we're not supposed to hug you really hard afterwards?
I think it's safest not to.
Okay. All right.
Good.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
All right.
Richard Iowade.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast was brought to you by Audible.com. Visit audible.com/Nerdist for a free audiobook download.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this, perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients, popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.